Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We've been following the story of Miguel Estrada, nominated to the second highest court in the land. His nomination, well, it isn't stalled. It's sitting there in the Senate under what is called a filibuster. And we're going to explore this whole concept of the Senate filibuster during this first few minutes of the second hour of Issues Etc. and find out why Dean Douglas Kamek believes that this particular form of filibuster, in the case of Estrada, is bordering on unconstitutional. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And then a little later in the hour, and for the remainder of the hour, we'll talk with Dr. David Cook, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas, an author of a forthcoming book called Studies in Muslim Apocalyptic, about the end times teaching of Islam and how much they may play in terrorist groups and in the Muslims' world views of the events in the Middle East. Dean Douglas Kamek is Dean of the Catholic University Law School. He's Senior Policy Fellow at Pepperdine University. He formerly served as the head for the Office of Legal Counsel in the Reagan and in the first Bush administrations, and he's author of an op-ed piece recently in the Wall Street Journal. Dean Kamek, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What exactly is a filibuster?
Well, a filibuster, as most of your listeners will recognize, is a way to talk an issue to death, is to basically to historically to take the floor and to debate it, and in the absence of a cloture vote or a vote to close off discussion, prevent it from being fully considered.
Is the filibuster an artifact of Senate rules, or is it recognized any place in the Constitution itself?
It appears nowhere in the Constitution. It is a practice that originates in the middle of the 19th century, but it exists in a different form now than it existed then. And when it originated, it really required the vim and vigor and physical vitality to maintain the floor and to prevent others from taking it for any other purpose. And it had the capacity, therefore, to totally paralyze the legislative process as a way of expressing disagreement with the issue to be taken up. Now, all one really has to manifest is the potential ability to maintain a filibuster. And what that means is that you need 60 votes to close debate under Senate rules. And if you can demonstrate that in informal ways that you have those 60 votes, the issue never comes to the floor for consideration.
So the modern filibuster, sometimes called the silent filibuster, if we were to observe this, say, go into the Senate chambers, we wouldn't see a bunch of sweaty senators with their ties undone holding forth for hours and hours into the dead of night on the issue of Miguel Estrada's nomination to the second highest court in the land. What would we see?
You would see business as usual, and as a result, you would not know a filibuster was being conducted. Now, occasionally, the majority leader, Senator Frist, has brought Mr. Estrada's nomination to the floor, and accompanying that nomination has been an hour or two of debate set aside to consider his nomination, but nowhere near the tradition of filibuster that has existed in the past.
So was the original intent of the filibuster rule to basically say to the deliberative body that is the Senate, if you are going to debate an issue of such importance that you're going to engage this rule, you will also pay the consequence of shutting down the other business of the Senate?
Therefore, that's right.
Something to be avoided.
In essence, it said to the country and to the body that this issue was of such extreme importance that it required a supermajority, more than a simple majority, to address it. And it required the kind of physical stamina necessary to maintain the floor for hours on end to the preclusion of any other discussion.
Now, this kind of raises a question of the Constitution versus Senate rules. Is it possible that this particular silent filibuster rule in the Senate rules could be unconstitutional?
Well, I think it is, and as you noted in your introduction, I've written a brief essay to this effect in the Wall Street Journal, but let me briefly explain why. The President of the United States and the Senate of the United States share the appointment power. The President nominates, and the full Senate of the United States, all 100 senators, have the authority to give advice and consent on those nominations. The President is being denied by the silent filibuster or the stealth filibuster the opportunity to have his nominees considered by the full Senate. Instead, where the constitutional text calls for a majority of senators to either vote a nominee up or down, the Senate rules on filibusters calls for 60 votes to be necessary to confirm a nominee. This seems to me to be on its face contrary to the majoritarian principles that our founders wrote into the Constitution, and this is especially so when you take into consideration that there are 7 places in the Constitution where express requirements for supermajorities, such as overriding a presidential veto, are provided for. But even more troublingly is that there is a long-established tradition in parliamentary democracies, whether they be in England or the United States, that one legislative body cannot govern another. So that this Senate, for example, couldn't pass a law that couldn't be repealed by a subsequent Senate. And yet, we have a rule in place, namely a cloture rule in place, that has been continued from Senate to Senate without ever having been approved by the latest individuals elected to that body, which I think is not only a default in terms of the constitutional text, but gives offense to those who participated in the electoral process in the last round and elected new people to the Senate.
All right. Could you fill us in on Miguel Estrada's particular situation right now? Is it fair to say that his nomination is stalled, for lack of a better word?
Well, the President has convinced 55 senators, which of course is far more than needed to secure his confirmation, that Mr. Estrada should serve on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit.
He only needs 51 votes, right,
to confirm? That's correct. We need a simple majority. And unfortunately, Mr. Estrada is not being given a vote because in order to close debate on his nomination, 60 votes under this continuing Senate rule is necessary. And so the function given to the full Senate of the United States is basically being deprived of it, and Mr. Estrada's nomination is paralyzed.
I read in Washington Post last week, Wednesday, that the Senate Democrats blocked a prompt vote on President Bush's nomination from the Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen, who's been in the news before, of course, to a federal appeals court, but stopped short of saying that they will attempt to prevent her confirmation. Is it possible that it's an equally contentious nomination, that she too would be subject to the same kind of stealth filibuster?
Well, I think that's right. I think she is subject to the same kind of stealth filibuster as a political matter. And I think this illustrates how constitutional government is being defeated by unfaithful procedural rules. Now, you might ask yourself, is there anybody in a position to file suit against this kind of mischief? And that's a more difficult constitutional question, but I think one could at least speculate that there are two possible plaintiffs. One would be the nominee himself or herself, whose nomination has been deprived of consideration by the full Senate. They may well be argued to have standing in a federal court to raise the issue. But also any individual member of the Senate whose capacity to represent us is diminished by his or her inability to cast a vote could theoretically bring that case as well. Now, we have had occasions in history where two vice presidents on either side of the political spectrum, Vice President Nixon in 1957 and Vice President Humphrey in 1969, both ruled from their bench that the Senate's continuing imposition of rules from prior bodies was unconstitutional. And so there is some historical precedent that raised objection, but for political reasons, those objections were not followed up on either in federal court or by the Senate itself.
Would such a lawsuit, be it brought by the nominee himself or by an individual senator who says that his ability to represent is being diminished here, would such a lawsuit, if won, have the effect of declaring the Senate rule on the silent, this 1970s rule, the silent filibuster, unconstitutional?
I think it would probably focus most directly on the provision of the Senate rules that makes it impossible to change a Senate rule from a previous sitting of the Senate except by two-thirds of the vote. That's the most troublesome offense, it seems to me, against the Constitution. The notion that a previous Senate, long dead and gone, could have a continuing effect on the present Senate. It's as if something got enacted into law with a provision that said this could never be repealed no matter what we learned in the future. We would never tolerate that as a constitutional matter, and yet we're seemingly tolerating it in this instance with regard to the treatment of presidential nominations.
So it sounds as though the simplest solution here, not only for Miguel Estrada, but for the future of the Senate, and in particular Bush judicial nominees, would be for the Senate, if such a thing were possible, by a two-thirds majority, overturn the silent filibuster rule.
That would be the best course, but of course it's difficult to get two-thirds within the Senate for that proposition. But here's some hope that I think there is some hope. There is some discussion presently in Washington that perhaps the Senate Judiciary Committee will take up this issue and will conduct a full hearing into the propriety or impropriety of the stealth or silent filibuster. And if that was the case, it might lead the senators, as the greatest deliberative body, as they like to call themselves, to correct this constitutional error. Alternatively, it's not inconceivable that as Vice President Nixon and Humphrey both ruled from their presiding position, that Vice President Cheney could some afternoon take the floor and rule similarly, thereby breaking the logjam over Mr. Estrada or Judge Owen, and raise the legal issue that way and bring it into court.
And all those things, of course, have unknown political consequences beyond just what happens in the Senate next.
Of course, and that's why it's nobody likes to change something that's been around a long time, even if it's been around in error for a long time. And, of course, if these arguments were made, people would make arguments of acquiescence and estoppel and, you know, implied ratification, and they don't know how they'll come out. But this is a question of some importance, because here we have an example of a Senate minority, if you will, depriving the will of the majority, which is quite contrary to our constitutional intentions, and thereby doing damage to the co-equal branches of the government, both to the executive in terms of the president's ability to nominate people for the bench, and to the judiciary that has to operate with a reduced staff with regard to an ever-increasing docket.
Two final questions. What kind of precedent has there been, if any, for filibustering judicial nominees?
Well, there's hardly any. The one precedent that people can point to before Mr. Estrada is a precedent dealing with the late Abe Fortas, who had been suggested by Lyndon Johnson very late in his term to be elevated to the Chief Justice position on the Supreme Court of the United States. There were many questions raised about Mr. Fortas's financial dealings, and ultimately those questions led to his resignation from the court, as well as the defeat of or the withdrawal of his elevation to the Chief Justice position. So there was a case where the filibuster perhaps helped us avoid a mistake, but you can't... You can't get to a principled conclusion usually by an unprincipled means, and that's really about the only time in history that anyone points to. Certainly it is very extraordinary to use it for an appellate nomination, such as those of Priscilla Owen or Miguel Estrada, and indeed very unfortunate that these two people who are really being opposed, probably because they have articulated in one fashion or another traditional or conservative views that are of dislike to some more liberal elements in the Senate, that their nominations aren't being considered on fair terms in terms of their merit or capability.
You conclude your essay in the Wall Street Journal writing, ultimately, what is being filibustered here is the right of all of us who voted. What do you mean by that?
Well, we voted to send to the new Senate at least one-third new membership. At least one-third of the Senate's membership was up for re-election in the last election, and that created a new Senate. You know, every time a new Senate sits, it sits under a new congressional number. It reforms itself in terms of committees. And all of the nominations that had been pending in the old Senate have to be resubmitted. So the work begins anew. And it's the expectation of the people who voted in the last election that their voices and the matters that they thought were important were going to be heard and attended to. And it's not inconceivable that in the last election that part of that related to judicial nominations, because prior to the most recent months, when the Republicans have a slight majority in the Senate, the president's ability to nominate judicial officers was being defeated by another nefarious means, and that is not by a vote of the full Senate, but by a denial of hearings in committee, or denial or a negative vote in the committee itself. And so to the extent that you and I in the last election went to the polls and elected someone different to the United States Senate who would be more responsible and responsive on the issue of judicial nominations, our voice is not being heard because the filibuster has drowned it out.
Dean Douglas Kamek, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
It's a pleasure.
Dean Douglas Kamek is Dean of the Catholic University Law School, Senior Policy Fellow at Pepperdine University, and he served formerly as the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Reagan and in the first Bush administrations. He's author of an op-ed piece recently in the Wall Street Journal. We're turning our conversation now toward the end times views of Islam. It might come as a surprise to many that Islam has, at least in some quarters, a rather well-developed eschatology, end times scenario. And we're going to talk about that for the remainder of this hour of Issues Etc. Our guest joining us via telephone is Dr. David Cook, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas, and author of a forthcoming book titled Studies in Muslim Apocalyptic. Dr. Cook, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Could you describe briefly if there is a single scenario, the typical end time scenario of Islam?
Well, I must admit, there are, like your question intimated there, there is no single scenario. I have constructed what I consider to be the dominant scenario, which basically involves a division into two fundamental parts, what are known as the lesser signs of the hour, in other words, the hour of judgment or the hour of resurrection, and the greater signs of the hour. The lesser signs of the hour are those moral or social or in some cases cosmic or natural events that will precede the coming of the hour. In other words, they serve as markers for the events that are the cataclysmic events that are due to take place at the end of the world. Then the greater signs of the hour are the appearance of the Antichrist, which is strikingly similar to that in Christianity, and then his killing at the hands of Jesus, who will return a second time in Islam, and then the appearance of a messianic figure known as the Mahdi, who will usher in a state of messianic peace and plenty and justice, after which the world will eventually degrade to some extent, kind of losing its messianic side, and then eventually then the hordes of Gog and Magog will appear and destroy the world.
Now, this is quite interesting because there are several figures here that also appear in some sectors of Christian apocalyptic as well, namely the Antichrist and the role of Christ, of Jesus returning here. We'll get to that in just a moment. How does this end-time scenario, the dominant end-time scenario you've just described, fit within the context of Islamic teaching as a whole?
Well, it's a fundamental part. It basically finishes off the world. It's a map, a roadmap, I suppose you might call it, of future history. It shows the Muslim what's going to happen. It gives people confidence to some extent. It also keeps them on their toes to know that they're at some time or another they might be tempted by these different nefarious creatures. It gives them hope that there's going to be a messianic period of justice and plenty. So it's a really fundamental part of Islamic teaching.
You mentioned before that Muslims do differ to a certain extent in their end times views. That being the dominant view, could you describe briefly, with about 2 minutes here before our break, other views that exist within the Muslim world of the end times?
Well, mainly it's a question of emphasis. For example, in Shiite beliefs, Shiites being the subsidiary sect of Islam, comprising about 10 to 15% of total world Muslims, the appearance of the Mahdi, the messianic figure, is far more crucial and far more important than in Sunni Islam. So in Shiite scenarios, basically the Mahdi is the dominant figure, and Jesus hardly appears at all. The Antichrist is also not particularly important in Shiite visions of the end of the world. So I think it's a question more of emphasis rather than of personality change. There's also questions about the order of the events. In some cases, the Mahdi appears before the Dajjal, the Antichrist, appears. In other cases, he appears first and then vice versa. So.
Do all of these scenarios, whatever they may be in the Islamic religion, do they all involve end times proselytization or end times mass conversion to Islam?
Yes, most of them do. Basically, the idea of the Messianic Age is that either people will want to live peacefully under the rule of an Islamic ruler, usually the Mahdi, or will convert to Islam under his direction.
And finally, with only 30 seconds before we go to this break, who is the Mahdi believed to be? Is it Muhammad?
No. He's a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, not the Prophet himself. There's no, the Prophet does not return back in Islam, and he has no part to play in the end times. He's a descendant of the Prophet, a righteous man who's empowered by God.
Dr. David Cook is our guest. We're talking about the end times teachings of Islam. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation for the remainder of this second hour of Issues, Etc. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call during this break, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. David Cook is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What did Jesus say and do on the night he was arrested? In our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, the very first Easter, Dr. Paul Meyer retells for your family and your children the story of Jesus' betrayal, arrest, crucifixion, and resurrection. You can order the very first Easter online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, be sure to ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, the very first Easter. The cost is $12.99, 1-800-325-3040. Call weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Everyone agrees that pregnancy rates are dropping. The reason why is what's debated. Liberals claim condoms are to thank. Pro-family groups point to abstinence. Now some science on the question. A landmark study says abstinence is the most significant factor in declining teen pregnancy and birth rates. Stuart Shepard reports.
A decline in teen pregnancy and birth rates began in 1991. The study released today analyzed factors behind that decline. Joanna Mohn is the primary author.
When we consider pregnancies to single teens, we found that two-thirds of the decline to those single teens was because more single teens were abstaining from sex.
She says the findings support educational programs with a pure abstinence message.
This really says that abstinence is working on a societal level.
At this public middle school, a panel of older teens is encouraging students to avoid drugs, alcohol, and sex.
Hi guys, we're the teen advisors. We're basically just high school and college students who go around the city talking about abstinence from risky behaviors.
Lindy Hargrave is 19.
They aren't educated about it. They don't know the dangers of it. They don't know the risks.
You think you're changing lives?
Yeah, sometimes it's not easy to see that.
Peter Brandt with Focus on the Family says the new study paints that bigger picture.
What it shows is that abstinence is the primary reason for the decline in the teen birth and pregnancy rates.
He hopes Washington is listening.
It is the MAPS abstinence message and an unambiguous abstinence message, which is the message the teens are listening to. Congress needs to hear that.
The study is in the journal Adolescent and Family Health. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
The research overturns the conclusion of an older study by the pro-abortion Alan Guttmacher Institute. It credited contraceptives for the decline. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Sharon Ewell Foster about her book, Passing Into Light. We'll talk with Otis Cohen of Ameren and Audria Norman, a singer, about the Young Heroes in Music program and their upcoming concert. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Is the death and resurrection of Christ historically reliable? Find out with the new children's book, The Very First Easter, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Very First Easter is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New? The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the end time scenarios of Islam. If you'd like to join us with a question or comment, our guest is Dr. David Cook, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University and author of a forthcoming book titled Studies in Muslim Apocalyptic, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before the break, Dr. Cook, you mentioned that the Mahdi was not Muhammad, but a descendant of Muhammad, and he is a man empowered by God. Is it safe to say here that in the Islamic end time scenarios, there, even with the return of Jesus, he is returning merely as a man and not as a in any sense a divine figure?
Very much so. The story of Jesus inside the Quran is that of a righteous man who's a prophet and a messenger sent by God, but who was not crucified, but was lifted up by God in place of the crucifixion, and that he will be returned at the end of time in order primarily to kill the Antichrist, who's a negative Christ, I suppose you might say.
How, in general, I guess it raises this question, how do you account for the apparent similarities between Islamic end-time scenarios and those of some Christians?
Oh, well, they're very much rooted in the same traditions. The prophetic traditions of the Old Testament and the New Testament are very similar to the language that appears inside the Quran. The early Muslims, for the most part, were converted from Christianity. Many of them brought in Christian teachings into Islam. And fundamentally, the dominant discourse, the dominant apocalyptic discourse of the 7th and 8th century was basically Christian, and therefore it was very similar between these two the two faiths.
Would you conclude an influence from a Christian apocalyptic to the newly forming Muslim apocalyptic?
Yes, very much so. I mean, when you read the stories about the Antichrist, they are basically all taken from Christian sources, although they're given a Muslim lining, I suppose you might say. They are a framework. They are very much influenced by Christian sources. You can even find similar words, similar concepts, and so forth. There's really nothing in that particular line that's separating Islam from Christianity, other than the question of the divinity of Jesus.
In popular Christian apocalyptic, it has been in vogue for the last 30 years or so to engage in either kind of hardcore or softcore date setting for the various events that some Christians believe will occur in the end times, a secret rapture, a millennial kingdom, the return of Christ, these kind of things. Is there a similar impulse in modern-day Islam to date set with regard to their end-time scenario?
Most certainly. Date setting is one of the most dangerous things that an apocalyptic predictor can make, because he has to face the problems that he can either, if he dates himself close, he might actually find that he's the subject of ridicule if his predictions do not come about. If he dates himself far away, then he's in serious danger of losing his audience, because no one cares what happens in 100, 200 years or something like that. But contemporary Muslim apocalyptic writers have very frequently during the last 10, 15 years tried to date things. They issued a lot of predictions around the year 2000. They've issued various different predictions about the end of the State of Israel and various different other events that are due to happen.
You mentioned Israel. What role does the Muslim apocalyptic assign to the modern State of Israel?
Well, for them, Israel is basically either a manifestation of the Antichrist or his tool. And many of the events due to take place in the end at the end of the world take place within the geographical confines of the State of Israel, especially in Jerusalem. And so it's extremely important for Muslim apocalyptic writers to fit Israel into their overall calculations. Usually the fall of the State of Israel, the predicted fall of the State of Israel, is seen as one of the signs that will lead up to the end of the world. And so oftentimes Muslim apocalyptic books have major sections on prophecy, trying to calculate the end of the State of Israel through various different means.
And so that would be considered, Israel would be considered, and its fall, one of those things you spoke of before, the lesser signs of the hour.
Yes, but it would be one that, since many of them see Israel so closely connected to the Antichrist, it would be one that would lead directly into the greater sign. So perhaps maybe you could define it as a hinge sign, something that would hinge between the greater and the lesser signs.
Tell us about the Muslim figure of the Antichrist. Who, not in particular, but what kind of figure is this?
This is a monstrous character. He's usually said to be blind in one eye and to have the word infidel written across his forehead. Despite his monstrous appearance, he is said to be an attractive character. So somehow or another, God apparently, or maybe I shouldn't say God, I'll say he's able to conceal his malevolent nature behind some type of a veil, which only true Muslims will be able to see. But he will be a subject of temptation. He will bring temptation to people en masse, and the vast majority of humanity will fall for his temptation, even quite a number of Muslims.
Will he be a political or a religious figure, or a little bit of both?
Well, in the classical sources, he's usually just said to be a political figure. I mean, a person who simply he doesn't attempt to establish a political entity in any form, but he just apparently leads a mass movement, which I suppose we might say is religious in nature, but it's not necessarily, it doesn't form like a cult of any nature. Today, he's given much more of a sinister appeal, more along the lines of the Antichrist that one might find in contemporary evangelical literature and so forth.
We're talking with Dr. David Cook about the end times teaching of Islam. If you would like to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 are our phone numbers. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, thank you for waiting and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, my question is Islamic end times writing, is it based on squarely on the Quran and on the Hadith? Or are they just borrowing, is this popular writing, and are they borrowing from, for example, are they, maybe a smart Muslim might read the Tim LaHaye books and say, hey, this is making a lot of money, maybe I can adapt this to Islam and run with it. I guess my question is it really grounded in their scriptures?
Thank you, Kurt.
That's an excellent question. Thank you so much for asking it. Yes, it is grounded squarely in the Hadith, although contemporary Muslim apocalyptic literature does make extensive use of the Christian Bible, especially through the lenses of evangelical writers. And it also makes extensive use of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory based in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So the answer to your question is kind of both. There is definitely a major classical Muslim source for the materials, but it is reinterpreted through contemporary materials, which, although I've never seen anybody use Tim LaHaye's book, they certainly cite things like Hal Lindsey and different other popular evangelical writers. I've seen Jerry Falwell cited and quite a number of others.
So is it safe to say that that the Muslims' apocalyptic is as eclectic in its sources as even some of the popular Christian apocalyptic is?
Yes, that would definitely be correct.
What's the role of war in particular, some type of final battle scenario in Muslim end times teaching?
Well, there's a lot of, basically the Muslim apocalyptic literature was written during the times when the Muslims were going through what we call the Great Muslim Conquests of the 7th and 8th century. And so most of the apocalyptic literature basically portrays either battles that should have gone to the Muslims and didn't, or projects many of the conquests that the Muslims were unable to make onto the Messianic Age. In other words, the Mahdi will conquer that area of the world that the Muslims were unable to conquer during their initial period of conquest. So there's a lot of pictures of battles inside the Muslim apocalyptic literature. They aren't reducible down to one Armageddon sort of type of battle, but contemporary Muslim apocalyptic writers have definitely borrowed the word Armageddon, and it appears actually on a lot of their book titles. And so they've, in some ways, they've been influenced by that, having one final battle between good and evil and so forth.
To what degree are the end times views of Islam an operative impulse in Muslim terrorist groups?
They're quite strong. There's several different scenarios that are being used right there. One is a basic messianic scenario that we find used occasionally by Osama bin Laden. The area in which the Mahdi is supposed to appear, the Muslim messianic figure, is the area that was known in classical Islam as Khorasan, which today is eastern Persia, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. And so in many of Osama bin Laden's proclamations and so forth, he uses that, or has used that in the past, for to gain appeal. I don't consider him to be personally a messianic figure, although I've seen some radical Muslims on the internet who have tried to build that aspect of him up. More likely candidate appears to have been Mullah Omar, who, after he conquered Kabul in 1996, actually took the caliphal title of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, indicating that perhaps he did consider himself to be a Mahdi or some equivalent thereof. That's one aspect of things. The other aspect that's oftentimes brought out is the fighting aspect. And so oftentimes radical Muslims will try and reinterpret, especially losses, battle losses, in apocalyptic terms. And for this, they're very, very well equipped with classical Muslim apocalyptic literature, because in many cases, the battle scenes in the classical literature do not actually demonstrate the immediate victory of Islam. They show a process by which the Muslims are, the less than faithful Muslims are weeded out, and God allows a victory to be obtained only by those who are completely faithful. And so in many cases, radical Muslims today, for example, try and interpret the loss of Afghanistan, which was a terrible setback for them, in apocalyptic terms, that God only allowed this to happen in order to test the faithful and in order to winnow out those that were going to be less than pure. And so they also use this as a weapon against what they call apostate Muslims. According to their belief system, the vast majority of present-day Muslims are not actually non-Muslims. And so they want to sacrifice them or get rid of them or to somehow or another make it obvious to the rest of the world, that, at least to the Muslim world, that they aren't really Muslims. And the best way to do that is to perpetuate fighting, okay, to make sure that true Muslims are constantly fighting and the false ones will gradually fall away or lose interest and so forth.
So kind of a purification of Islam by attrition.
Yes.
Through war, in warfare.
Yes. Yeah, so those apocalyptic traditions are extremely useful for radical Muslims in that regard. There's one tradition that that they use quite frequently that says quote, that the nations are about to fall upon you, in other words, Muslims, like starving people upon a bowl of food. Now, radical Muslims cite this tradition just a tremendous amount because it indicates to them what they see as a worldwide conspiracy to destroy Islam or to attack Islam. And so some of these apocalyptic traditions are extremely useful for them.
What role do Muslims who engage in this kind of end-time speculation, what role do they believe that the U.S. plays in their end-time scenario, and in particular, the president occupant of the White House, George W. Bush?
Yeah. Well, obviously, the United States is not mentioned in the Hadith literature, and nor is it, of course, mentioned inside the Quran. And so, actually, one of my favorite books on the future destruction of the United States starts out by saying, "Why is the United States not mentioned in the Quran?" The guy says, "This is a question that every Muslim has asked himself." I don't know whether every Muslim has really asked himself that, although I suspect that probably many of the apocalyptists have definitely asked themselves that. You can, of course, reinterpret a lot of different things. Contemporary radical and apocalyptic Muslims usually reinterpret the term Antichrist, which in classical Islam is a personality, to be either a country or an idea or something larger than it was in classical times. And so in this way they can kind of create the United States as the paragon of evil inside the Muslim apocalyptic literature. there are some traditions about the Antichrist which say that he is chained on an island out in the West, okay, out in the West, somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, which if you expand it, then all of a sudden becomes the United States, out in the middle of nowhere and so forth. So, I mean, at least at that particular time it would have been. Muslims have also used certain discoveries that evangelical Christians have made in the Book of Revelation, for example, to discover, as it were, the United States and stuff, and to judge it by finding things like the downfall of Babylon the Great, which is described in Revelation 18, assigning it to the United States. One guy in 1994 wrote an entire book on that and connected it with certain verse in the Quran and so forth. Usually, at least in the material that I've seen so far, President Bush is not assigned necessarily a role in the end times materials. That may change, especially after the end of the war in Iraq. He's usually given other titles, other kind of negative titles. He's usually called the Pharaoh of this age, or using an idolatrous term, he's called the Hubal. Hubal was the principal idol, of the Meccan opponents of the Prophet Muhammad. And so he's sometimes said to be, you know, like the idol that everybody worships and so forth.
Tell us about any recent attempts to fit September 11th, that event, into the framework of Muslim apocalyptic.
Well, September 11th was such an amazing event that, at least for the radical Muslims, that it would be hard to believe that they didn't use it in some way. And, of course, they do. For them, September 11th was interpreted as the vanguard of the Mujahideen, the fighters for Islam, which struck the United States. And beyond that, they have a difficult time because obviously they lost their primary base as a result of September 11th, which is still a problematic issue. I mean, many of them have written different notices or letters or articles and stuff examining this question, but September 11th is usually seen as being a sign of some sort, a sign perhaps for those who are optimists of the decline of the United States, for those who are pessimists and maybe a little apocalyptic, for the initiation of what they call the New Crusader War. The war against Islam, for them, once again, this is a war that they need in order to survive. They need it to differentiate between true and false Muslims. And so for them, it was a desirable event, even though in the end they lost Afghanistan and several different other places as well.
Should the Bush administration or any future administrations take these apocalyptic teachings into account when they are considering how to frame up their foreign policy, especially vis-a-vis predominantly Muslim nations?
Well, I'm not sure that they need to take them too deeply. I mean, the United States is so widely hated within the Muslim community and the Middle East in general that I'm not sure that it really pays to nuance it very much anymore.
So there's very little that any administration could do to try and dissuade the opinions of the U.S. according to this apocalyptic framework.
Well, as Osama bin Laden said in his letter to the American people, really the only thing that you can do is just convert to Islam. So I don't know that there's much, you know, that you can add to that. I mean, there are certain things that I think that administrations should watch out for. The main explosive point with that is the negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel. Those that happened around the year 2000 were ultimately derailed by the questions of the Temple Mount or the the location of the present-day Dome of the Rock, which appears quite frequently in apocalyptic literature, and it's hard to say whether precisely the riots that broke out in September of 2000 were specifically or even indirectly related to the apocalyptic predictions for that year, but there were a lot of apocalyptic predictions that said that the Jews during that year are going to try and rebuild their temple, going to try and destroy the Dome of the Rock, and so, yeah, I mean, I probably, you know, in that particular situation, I think I would have been a lot more sensitive to that particular, those predictions. But there's many other cases where it's hard to see how on earth the United States could or even should take these things into account without just radically changing our foreign policy overall.
Finally, and with only a minute to answer here, Dr. Cook, how popularly are these end-time scenarios believed by Muslims, in particular in the Western world?
Well, you can find them all over the Internet. Anybody who just pushes in the word Dajjal or Mahdi into a good search engine can find quite a good deal of stuff in English. There's a lot of stuff in Arabic. There's stuff in Urdu. It's widely communicated. However, it's a subject of debate as to how many precisely Muslims actually believe it. From my own travels in the Arabic world, it's sold widely, and that's really as much as I can say. To my knowledge, most Muslims are at least familiar with these things. Whether they actually believe them or not, I think really depends upon a situation. If the situation is dramatic and catastrophic, then obviously more tend to believe. If it's less, then it definitely can drop off the radar screen.
Dr. David Cook, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. This is certainly a pleasure.
Dr. David Cook is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas, and author of a forthcoming book titled Studies in Muslim Apocalyptic. When we come back from this break, Dr. Bob Weiss joins us here in Studio A. He's Associate Professor of Practical Theology and Professor of Pastoral Ministry in the Life Sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We'll talk about the viability of human cloning, a recent story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. According to the Associated Press, human cloning may be impossible, study finds. We'll find out why that is a conclusion. And then we'll conclude our hour of Issues Etc. talking with Pastor Richard Stuckwish of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. He will give us the lowdown on Palm Sunday. That's coming up in the next hour of Issues Etc. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.